Well, let's continue then, because what I want to do is not step through this program one instruction at a time. There are too many instructions. I want to show you some shortcuts, a way to speed up this analysis. And specifically, I want to show you how to speed up the unpacking of this program. Yeah. The program is not unpacked. Absolutely. Yeah. We're just starting to unpack it. There's a lot more to do. But what we have done is we found ourselves a little bit further along. And if we wanted to, and if we had no idea how to approach this process with a shortcut, then we'd continue stepping through each instruction one by one and trying to understand what they do. But I want to show you a shortcut. Before I show you a shortcut, I want to tell you one thing that you should be keeping an eye out for. There are a lot of instructions that the program will need to execute to unpack itself. And it's oftentimes hard to find the end of the unpacking code. In the example that I showed you on the second day of the class, it was pretty easy. We just scrolled down and we saw that the code ended. Oh, that was the end. In many cases, the actual end of the unpacking code might be in the middle of some code block. Might be hard to do. But here is something to look out for. This doesn't work all the time, but sometimes can save you a lot of time. What I found is that at the end of many unpacking, well, at the end of an unpacking code in many samples that I have seen, there's a jump or a call to the EAX register. Remember that in the example that we saw with UPX, once it finished unpacking itself, it jumped to the address in memory where the unpacked code resided. And I find that many unpackers store that address within the register EAX. So as you step through the code and you're looking to understand where does it finish unpacking the program, look out for a jump or a call to EAX. Not all jumps or calls to EAX are going to be the end of the unpacking code. This is just one of those rules of thumb that might help you find yourself at the end of the unpacking code. All right, so as we're going to be going through this, keep an eye out for a call or a jump to EAX. Doesn't always work. But unfortunately, in this particular topic, I don't have a sure way of telling you how to do anything. I'm just going to give you some tips like this one. So the question is the following. How can we find ourselves at the end of the unpacking code without having to step through every single instruction? And this problem is one that a lot of malware reversers try to solve, and it's a common problem, so there's a term I want you to be aware of. The term is original entry point. What does that mean? Well, the original program that the attacker created was compiled, and in it there was the entry point field. Once the program has been packed, that entry field was modified so that Windows begins executing the unpacking code. So when I say that we're looking for the end of the unpacking code, it's equivalent to me saying that we're looking for the beginning of the unpacked program, which is the same thing as looking for the original entry point. All right, so I say end of the unpacking code is similar to looking for the original entry point, OEP. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the OEP. And here's the technique that works pretty well that I wanted to share with you. It works in several different packers. And here is the reason why this technique works and what I'm going to do. What we just saw was the packer defining its SCH record before it began unpacking the program. To do this, it had to write to the stack, right? We saw that. It's writing to the stack. So what I want to do is anticipate the fact that once the unpacking code finishes running, it'll probably need to clean up the stack. For example, it'll need to remove those fake exception handling records that it had defined. So what I'm going to show you is a technique that allows you to set a breakpoint on the stack. This way, when the unpacker finishes running, it's going to access that part of the stack again during the cleanup process, and we're going to catch it in action. We're going to set a breakpoint on the current part of the stack. Now, we're just starting the unpacking, and we're setting the breakpoint at the current part of the stack. As the unpacker unpacks the program, the stack is going to grow because it's going to be adding stuff to the stack. It's going to shrink. It's going to grow again. But when it finishes unpacking, usually it's going to clean up the stack to the way it was in the beginning of the program's execution. And that's why we're going to look to set the breakpoint on this part of the stack. Does that make sense conceptually? Let me show you how we're going to do this. There are several ways of doing this. Let me show you on the screen, and then I'm going to let you try this out in your lab. So I'm going to start this from the beginning. I don't want to analyze it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the program a chance to write, to execute just a few instructions so that it begins writing to the stack. And because it is common for unpackers to begin by writing SCH records to the stack, this technique is applicable across several different packers. So I'm going to step through some of these instructions. I'm going to press F8 three times to execute three instructions. One, two, three. And I'm looking for a reference to the ESP register because this is where it's referencing the top of the stack. Right now, ESP is, as always, pointing to the top of the stack. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to click on the ESP register because ESP is pointing to the top of the stack, right? I clicked on that register, and what I'm going to do then is I'm going to right-click on it, and I'm going to say follow in dump. What this will do is it will bring me to the top of the stack in this leftmost window that shows me memory, and that'll make it easy for me to set a breakpoint there. So I waited for the program to reference ESP. In this case, I had to execute three instructions, and when it's sitting at that breakpoint, I'm going to click on the ESP register and say follow in dump. Click. And now the dump pane is the one that's at the bottom left corner of the screen. This is the dump pane. This is where it shows you memory data. And what I want to do now is set a breakpoint there. Now this is a different breakpoint from the one that we've been setting before. Before we've been setting breakpoints upon execution of specific instructions. But we can also set a different kind of breakpoint on data so that whenever this particular area of the memory gets accessed, all the debug is going to pause. And what I need to do now is I need to highlight, let me see, 4 bytes. 4 bytes because this is how many bytes are used to keep track of addresses that are saved on top of the stack. So I highlight 4 bytes here, and I right-click there, and I select breakpoint, hardware, on access, D-word. Hardware is a more reliable way of setting breakpoints. In many cases, you end up setting breakpoints by pressing F2. These are known as software breakpoints. What happens behind the scenes, you don't see it when you set a regular F2 software breakpoint, is that OliDebug actually overrides the instruction where you want to set the breakpoint with an interrupt. You don't see it, it happens behind the scenes. So when you set a regular software breakpoint, you actually end up temporarily modifying the program that you're debugging. So a lot of analysts prefer to set hardware breakpoints. Hardware breakpoints make use of the specialized functionality that Intel implemented in their CPU. They're more reliable. But you can only set very few hardware breakpoints at a given time. But with software breakpoints, you can set as many of them as possible. When setting breakpoints on the stack, the most reliable way to do it is to set it as a hardware breakpoint. And we're setting the breakpoint called on access, which basically means anytime this part of the stack gets accessed, pause and let me look around. And I'm selecting D word because that's the 4 bytes that I have selected.
The difference between the byte word and D word options?
Well, one is a byte. That's just, if we had highlighted a single byte, then we would need to, who asked the question, sorry. If we highlighted a single byte, then we'd need to set a breakpoint on that particular byte. But because we highlighted D word, which is 4 bytes, we need to select D word. But in this case, you'll always be selecting D word because that's how much data is used to keep track of memory addresses.
And then word is just some
word is half of that. So D word is double word. All right, so I'm clicking this to select the breakpoint. Now, unfortunately, there is no visual indication that the breakpoint was set, so I'm going to have to hope that I clicked correctly. So what happened now is that I have now set an access breakpoint on the current top of the stack. And now I'm going to continue running the program. It's going to run. So I'm going to say debug run. I don't want to be stepping through all the instructions. It's a waste of my time. I'm looking for shortcuts. And here's one of those. So I'm going to click run. And almost instantaneously, the program is paused. Why is it paused? Because the debugger noticed that the program is accessing that part of the stack where I set my breakpoint. Now is when I may think, hey, is the program unpacked yet? Any ideas for how I might answer the question, is the program unpacked yet? Look at strings embedded into it. Take a look at what strings are embedded into it. What I end up doing in many cases is dumping it using OLLIDUMP and looking at those strings on trying to run it. That's usually how I find out whether the program has been unpacked or not. And in this case, the program has not yet been unpacked. I'm going to save you the time. I did it already. It's not unpacked yet. But that's okay. Not every access to that part of the stack means that we're done unpacking. Maybe it's going to keep using the stack some more. So, okay, I'm going to run again. Play. And it looks like it just executed a few more instructions and paused again. I doubt it would have had a chance to unpack itself yet. But if I wasn't sure, I'd dump it, look at the strings, analyze it. Nope, not unpacked yet. Okay, let's try it again. Debug, run.
What if the text is XORed?
Well, in most cases, an unpacked program would still have at least some strings, more strings that are visible than if the program is packed. Maybe these are references to API calls. Not all strings will usually be XORed, just a few really important ones. So my quick way of determining whether a program is packed is usually by looking at the strings. But there are others. I could scan the program with PID, for example. The PID, as I will show you later on, would also, even if it cannot identify a packer, can do some byte distribution histograms that will show you how likely is it that the executable is still packed. So there are several ways to determine whether the program has been packed or not. In this case, it's not yet, so I'm going to continue running until I think the program may have been unpacked. And in this case, it ran a bit more. And if I dumped the program now, I would see many more strings than before. But I wanted to show you a slightly more precise way of dumping it, because look at what's right below this particular instruction. Notice a jump to EAX. That's one of those things that I told you to look out for, a call to EAX or a jump to EAX, because in many cases, unpackers finish their dirty work by jumping or calling to EAX. So instead of dumping it right now, I'm actually going to take that jump. So to do that, I'm going to execute one instruction by pressing F7 or F8. Now I need to take the jump again by pressing F7 or F8. And now this looks pretty good. If I were to spend some time scrolling through this program, I would see some strings. Now I'm going to dump it. Plugins, OLLIDUMP. Dump debugged process. I'm not going to make any changes, just dump it. I'll call it dumped.exe. And now, if I look at the strings embedded into the program, this dumped one, it looks like it has been unpacked. Now, can it run? Can I run it? Well, it crashes. But that's okay. I'll show you how to fix that shortly. I wanted you mainly to determine how to find yourself at the end of the unpacking code. And that's what we just did. Yeah, a question. Let me come over and I'll take a look. So let me give you some time to play with this. The instructions for what I just did are in your books. And the instructions start on page 23 and go until 32. So please go through that. If you get stuck somewhere, let me know. 23 until 32. I wanted to show you, now that you've unpacked the executable, who was able to unpack it and got an executable file on the file system? All right, good. So as you saw, it doesn't really run, right? It crashes when you try to run it. So here's one way to fix a lot of these problems. It works pretty well. Let me fast forward to that slide. If you dump a program and it crashes, here's how you may be able to fix the problem. LordPE may be of help. LordPE, which is a tool that we used for dumping, well, that's not why I want to use it now. It's got this feature called RebuildPE, And this feature fixes a lot of common problems in the P header. Not all of them, of course, but quite a few. So let me show you how to do that. You'll be able to try it in your lab. So now that I've dumped my malicious executable, I no longer need only debug. I'm just going to exit it. And I'm about to modify this dumped file, so I'm going to make a backup copy of it because there's something else I wanted to show you. I'm going to call it dumped original. So I launch LordPE. Here it is. And I say rebuild PE. I point it to the dumped file. And then it rebuilds it. It's got some algorithms that determine how to fix it. It looks for common errors in the PE header. And it says that it's done. All right, cool. Let's see if it is really done. So it fixed this executable file called dumped on the fly. Does it run now? Let me double click on it. Hey, it's not quite the same as before. Find error. It says requerido Windows NT server. I don't know. Is this? I think this might be Portuguese. I'm not sure. Anybody knows? I don't know Portuguese. This looks like it might say Windows NT server required. So as a victim, you might say, I don't know what this was, but I guess it doesn't apply to me. But it's just another social engineering trick. Because if you click OK and you look at your processes, it is running. You've just infected yourself. So we were able to dump it and we were able to fix the P header and it really is running. So this was pretty clean. And now we can start analyzing it, doing behavioral analysis and code analysis, which is not something we're going to do in the class. If you're wondering what exactly did it change when LordPE fixed the header, let me kill the malicious process and show this to you. If you're wondering what LordPE did, you can look at this. LordPE has a P editor built into it. And I'm going to look at the file that it just fixed. And there's a feature called compare. So I can compare the P header of the file that it has fixed to the original dumped file. I called it dumped original. And now you can actually look at the P header field side by side and see how they're different. This is just if you're seeking additional insight into what exactly did LordPE do to fix the P header. But in most cases, unless you're just a really curious person by nature, you probably don't really care because you see that the executable runs normally. There's a little bit of social engineering there, it looks like, because it does tell you, it does prompt you with this slightly strange error message. Now, the error message actually might be more effective than you might realize. Now, of course, the victim here probably received this executable maybe through a malicious link, maybe as a malicious email attachment. And as a victim, if you are tricked into launching this program and you get this error message, well, you'll probably think that the file just isn't meant for you. Good thing it didn't run. But of course, we know that it's running. Here's another reason why I think this is an interesting anti-analysis measure. A lot of automated malware analysis tools, what do? They run your program and see what happens to it. And they run the program automatically without a human being there. If there is no human being here to click on this OK button, this program won't run. This program will only run once you click OK. This might be a defensive measure against some of the more primitive automated malware analysis tools that'll just automatically try to run the program. Somebody needs to be here to click OK. I think this might be another anti-analysis measure, but it doesn't work against us because we're human and we feel comfortable clicking OK. So, what did we learn so far? So far, we talked about the unpacking process as a search for the end of the unpacking code. Because if you can find that end of the unpacking code, that's equivalent to locating the original entry point. And if you can dump the program at that point, that means you've exposed it, and now you can analyze it using the techniques that we talked about yesterday and in the previous days of the class. On day two, we talked about one approach to do this with a simple packer like UPX. And right now, I showed you a pretty effective approach that works with many complex packers. The approach involved us noticing the use of the SCH handler, and we noticed when that SCH handler wrote something to the stack. We set an access breakpoint there, and this allowed us to really fast forward this analysis so that we found ourselves close to the end of the unpacking code. Any questions about this approach and what we're doing in general? Well, yeah.
How reliable is the Lord PE repair?
How reliable is the Lord PE repair? It's pretty good with some of the just simple PE header problems. Just in the past, it has worked well by me. The one area that Lord PE cannot fix reliably is if you need to correct problems in the import table. I don't believe, I mean, Lord PE tries to do that, but it doesn't really do an advanced job. But the good news is that the version of OLLIDUMP that I gave you has pretty good import table rebuilding functionality. So this version of OLLIDUMP combined with Lord PE ends up doing a pretty good job. But of course, there are plenty of problems that they won't fix. So you'll still need to tinker with things manually sometimes. All right, let's take a 20-minute break. In the meantime, if you have any questions about what we've done, come on over. But we'll resume in about 20 minutes. So we've got more to cover, more examples, more techniques. But before we do that, I wanted to show you that you may get lucky and find a tool that will automate some of these analysis and unpacking steps for you. I mentioned such a tool in one example briefly on the first day of the class. I wanted to mention a few more tools to you. If you do a lot of work in OLLIDEBUG, there is a capability that it offers to you to automate some of your actions. And that's done through a plugin called OLLISCRIPT. Now, OLLISCRIPT allows you to write scripts to automate certain features of OLLIDEBUG, but it is just really nasty to write scripts in OLLISCRIPT. The language is, nobody likes it. But there are some plugins for OLLISCRIPT that people have written to automate unpacking of certain things. To use them, you would need to, of course, have OLLISCRIPT installed, and then you would need to find somewhere on the web a script that people may have written to unpack the particular packer that you're dealing with. A good resource for finding these scripts is OpenRCE. If you Google OpenRCE, I think it's .net. It's one of those websites I mentioned on the first day of the class. You'll find that people have archived a bunch of scripts there. You will copy one of those scripts locally, then you go OLLISCRIPT, run script, load, and then it'll basically automate the steps that we just performed manually. And it'll say, okay, I'm done. I think I unpacked it. Now you can dump the program using OLLIDUMP. So look for these scripts. Sometimes they work. In my experience, OLLISCRIPTs are pretty unreliable. Even this particular script that I'm showing you here on the screen, and I believe I have a copy on your DVD, it doesn't work all the time for me. It's a little bit unpredictable. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I'm not a big fan of these scripts, but it's worth trying, because if they work, then they're going to save you a lot of time. If you do like the idea of scripting your debugger, then you might like the Immunity Debugger, which is just like OLLIDEBUG, and one of the major differences is that the Immunity Debugger, which is also free, allows you to write plugins in Python, and that's much more robust. And there's a pretty healthy community of developers who have written unpacking scripts for the Immunity Debugger. So check those out as well. And of course also, if you like using IDA Pro, which also has a debugger, IDA Pro has a pretty robust interface for writing add-ons for it as well. So you have several options there. And this is just, you've got some screenshots here that show you how I was able in some cases to use a script to unpack this particular example. Sometimes you're going to come across tools of dubious origin, but that work pretty well. Here's an example of this tool. It's a generic unpacker called Quick Unpack. I don't know who made it. I don't trust it to run outside of my sandbox environment, but when it works, it's pretty good. And it actually works quite well with this particular example. So I've got the screenshots in your book starting on page 43, but I wanted to show you in my lab. And this is one of the tools that you have on your DVD. So you run quick unpack. Of course, before you unpack a file, you need to open it. So I'm going to say open file, and I'm going to point it to the packed version of the sample that we've been analyzing. It's called quick unpack. It would be probably in the Well, where is it on the DVD? Let's take a look. It's under unpacking. Quick unpack. So one of the first thing the quick unpack does when you load an executable into it is it's got several tools built into it to try to identify the packer. Not just PEID, but it also uses PSniffer and some kind of a self-analyzer. In this case, all three agree that this is PCompact. This might be useful for you in case you wanted to research this packer manually. Now that I've loaded the executable into quick unpack, what I need to do is find OEP. Remember, OEP, the original entry point. This is equivalent to us finding the end of the unpacking code. That's really what we're oftentimes after. So to find the OEP automatically, first I need to enable this option called Use Force Unpacking. What does that do? Hard to say. Documentation for this tool is pretty lacking. But the consensus is that if you want it to be more reliable, then you're going to keep this option enabled. And that's what I usually do. So I enable Use Force Unpacking. Then you click the little right greater than sign, and you get to choose which of the generic OEP finding methods do you want to use. In my experience, the most reliable one is the one that it selects by default. But if that one doesn't work, try the other ones. I'm going to use the one that it selects by default. I double click. And now, look at this. It says some OEP has been detected at 402.8E8. And if you look at the beginning of the original code that we found manually, that matches it exactly. It was able to do it pretty quickly and automatically. So when these tools work, they save you a lot of time. Once you found the OEP using this tool, it's best to continue using this tool to actually unpack it. What this tool will do is it will run the malicious program within itself, so you will be actually infecting your system, and it'll try to automatically dump it at just the right time. So to do this, I'm going to say full unpack. Click this button. You can see it's running the program. Notice that error message comes up, the fake error message. We need to click OK to continue running the program. The tool is observing how the program is running, hooking the various API calls. And now it brings up the import table. If you want to, now you can manually modify how it will try to rebuild the import table so that the dumped executable is actually runnable. If you don't want to pay attention to what it says, it's okay. I don't blame you. In most cases, you can just click save and it's going to be okay. So I'm just going to click save. And it's continuing to dump the program. It is trying very hard to fix the PE header, to fix the import table, and it says done. Where did it dump the program that it thinks it unpacked? Right there in the file system. It's called Windows XP 2 underscore underscore. I just accidentally double clicked on it, but this is just a way for you to confirm that it actually is runnable. Yeah, it's runnable, and if you look at its strings, you will see that the strings are visible. It is indeed unpacked. So quick unpack, hey, pretty convenient. If it works, can save you a lot of time. Has anybody else used quick unpack? It looks pretty useful. There are several tools floating out there like this. I found this. It works in several cases, so I thought I'd share it with you.
So where did you find it?
Where did I find it? On just various hacker sites. So that's why I'm saying it's just of dubious origin. I don't know who's behind it.
Probably a hacker.
Yeah.
Someone else.
All right. But so keep in mind that these automated unpackers are out there. When they work, they can save you a lot of time. But I do want us to learn how to deal with situations where we don't have automation to help us with. So more examples of manual unpacking. And this is going to be an example of a program called BinText. But this is not the one that we've been using to look at strings. This is a different one that you're going to find in your malware directory under day 4. So grab a copy of that potentially malicious BinText and place it on your desktop. For this example, you're welcome to revert if you're not going to use any tools, or if you're afraid that you're going to lose some of your tools, it's probably okay to continue operating within your currently infected system. I don't think the two tools are going to interfere with each other, but the best option is to revert, and that's what I'm going to do. So this is a copy of BinText, and if you actually run it, you will notice that it behaves just like the legitimate BinText program. But then, if you look at its strings, bintext, if you look at bintext using bintext, which feels very just incestuous, then you really don't see much except some strings that might reveal to you the packer that's used to protect it. Let me show it to you on a screenshot. The strings suggest to you that this is packed with anti-kernel secure suite version 0.1, portable packer and protector library. And the reason I saw this is because I dropped this bintext into the legitimate bintext, and some of the strings showed me this sort of information. But if you look at it in PEID, it says nothing found. Nothing found. So PEID does not identify the packer here. One way in which you can use PEID to detect how likely is it that the executable is packed is using this feature that doesn't have a name. It's got greater than signs at the bottom right corner of PEID. When you click here, this will bring up a window called extra information. And when you look at extra information, you click at the button next to entropy, and this will do some statistical analysis of how evenly the various bytes within this file are distributed, and it's going to try to estimate how likely is it that it's packed. And right now, PEID says that it's packed. It just doesn't know which packer was used to pack it. So yeah, it looks like we're packed, but if you look at the strings, you may be able to identify the packer through strings and perhaps research it to understand what's going on. Maybe you're going to find some hints. I'm going to proceed under an assumption that you did not find anything. There is no help. You're on your own. So how would we proceed? Well, I'll show you a bunch of tricks in this example. But one of the first things I wanted to show you is that you can also use PEID to look at what external DLLs this executable relies upon. To do that, you would load the executable into PEID, and then you would click on the greater than button next to subsystem. Let me show this to you on my screen. This will give you a bit of extra information about the program. So I'm loading the program into PEID, not to scan it for packer identification, but to look at the subsystem. And after this, what I need to do is... Oh, boy. I think I need to click on import table. Yes. So I click on import table. There's a right greater than sign button next to import table. And this shows me the import table of this executable. The import table. What's in the import table? This is the information that's available to you. It tells you which external DLLs the executable relies upon. This particular executable relies on a single DLL. Kernel32.dll. That's pretty uncommon. Most Windows programs will rely on a lot more DLLs. This is one of the other indicators that the executable is packed. You click on that DLL, and it'll show you which API calls from that DLL the program wants to be able to use. And this one only needs two functions, load library and get proc adder. Also very uncommon. But you will see shortly that we can use this information to our advantage. You see, when a malicious program is packed, the packer will oftentimes protect the information about the original program's import table. Now, the original program, if it wasn't packed, Microsoft Windows would run it, it would look at the import table, and it would load the necessary DLLs into the memory space of the malicious process. But now the program is packed, and the packer conceals that import table to make our job more difficult. But it still needs to import a couple of API calls. Why? Because when the packed program runs on the victim's system, the unpacking code will need to manually load those DLLs that the original program relied upon. Does that make sense? Windows Loader won't help, because the Windows Loader no longer has the information. The unpacker will need to manually load those DLLs. What does it need to do to load the DLLs? Well, it will need to call load library to load the DLL, And it will also need to call getproc adder to map those functions within that DLL that the original program relied upon. That's why many packed programs won't show you DLLs and API calls from the original program, but they will still expose to you the fact that they're going to use load library and get proc adder. Any questions about this? How can we use this to our advantage? Well, one of the shortcuts that I'm going to show you soon for finding yourself close to the end of the unpacking process is to rely on the fact that the unpacker will need to make these API calls to load the code. And it'll make these API calls close to the end of the unpacking process. So what we're going to do is we're going to use OliDebug to set a breakpoint on one of these API calls. So that once the unpacker makes use of these API calls, there's a good chance that we're close to the end of the unpacking process. It's an approach that works pretty well. You can set a breakpoint at both of them, sure. I'm going to simplify things for our exercise, and I'll just pick one of them, but you could set the breakpoint on both of them, yeah.
You wouldn't know otherwise, right?
Yeah, yeah. One of them was usually sufficient, but both of them, you know, may be safer. So, let's start. Let's start by loading this executable into your OliDebug environment. How about that? So I'm going to take this potentially malicious version of Bintext, load it into OliDebug, and guess what? I'm already faced with my first defense that I need to bypass. OliDebug is refusing to load it. It runs fine on Windows, but if you try to load it into OliDebug, you get an error that says bad or unknown format of 32-bit executable. And if you click OK, it doesn't load it. What it's showing you is NTDLL, which you don't really care about. It's refusing to load the executable properly. What's going on? Well, what's going on is that the attacker modified the PE header to confuse OliDebug. OliDebug has several known bugs that haven't been fixed for a number of years. And attackers know about these bugs, and they also know that we use OliDebug to analyze their creations, so sometimes they will tinker with their PE headers to exploit these bugs, like in the case here. So what we need to do, one of the ways of handling this problem, is to manually modify the PE header to undo what the attacker did. Let me show you how to do that in case you ever need to do that. The tool that I like to use for this is called plister or xplister. It's a free tool of uncertain origin that I also gave you on your DVD. Some antivirus tools find it to be malware. I don't think the tool itself has anything malicious in it, but it is oftentimes used by hackers, so I guess some antivirus tools don't like it. I like the tool because it does this really well. The reason I like the tool is because I can load into it the malicious executable that's refusing to load into OliDebug, and this tool will try to automatically flag PE headers that look strange and unusual. So you see I've loaded the executable into plister, and it has marked with X signs several fields that look strange. What I would need to do now is do a bit of research on Google to find out what should be the proper values of these fields. And I've done some of that research, so I'm going to save you some time in the class. Yes?
I couldn't get it to load.
In your case, xplister doesn't load the executable? Let me take a look. Let me show you. There's actually, because I've already done the research to save us a bit of time, there's actually one field that you need to fix here. The other ones you can leave as is. The field that's giving OliDebug a hard time, and it's a well-known problem with OliDebug, so you're going to see this one quite frequently. The field is number of RVA and sizes. This is a field that's within the PE header that tells Microsoft Windows the size of one of several data structures that could be of variable size. And if you read Microsoft's documentation for this field, they will say that in most cases, the value of that field is supposed to be 10 in hexadecimal. So it's supposed to be 10, but right now it's set to this high value 4BA3. This is a known bug in OliDebug. OliDebug gets confused by this. No problem, though. Now that we know what should be the proper value through some Google research, double-click on number of RVA sizes and edit it to be 00000010. Then you click Save. Let me show you how to do that, and I'm going to ask you to do this in your lab as well. So I'm going to exit OliDebug and then drag and drop my program into plister. plister has got a number of cool features. You might want to play with it later. I'm just going to show you how you can use it to quickly edit this file. I select number of RVA and sizes, double click on it, and instead of this value, I'm going to say 0010. And I click save, and I also need to remember to go to file, save changes. Yes, save changes. Okay. Now, I can load this modified executable into OLEDebug, and it's no longer going to complain. It is able to load it now, and now I just get my common problem of OLEDebug saying that I'm not going to do continue analyzing it because it's a compressed code. And of course, I told you earlier that you should always say no when prompted with this question. So please go ahead and follow the instructions in your book to fix this particular pheader field. The instructions start on page 52 and end on page 53. Once you've fixed the pheader, you should be able to load it into OLEDebug and we can continue our analysis.